Welcome to the Big World Made Small podcast for the adventure traveler. I'm thrilled you're here. My name is Jason Elkins, and in addition to being your host, I'm also a former U.S. Army paratrooper, third-generation commercial hot air balloon pilot, paramotor pilot, ex-Montana fly fishing guide, advanced open water scuba diver, and a full-time nomad that's visited more than 30 countries on six continents. As a seasoned adventure travel expert with a passion for creating and sharing meaningful experiences, I'm on a quest to impact the lives of adventure travelers, tour operators they rely on, and the communities that host them. Every week, I bring you exclusive interviews with fascinating adventure tourism experts who have agreed to share their personal stories, favorite destinations, and some invaluable travel insights they've picked up along the way. We'll enjoy a casual conversation, create some connections, and likely share some laughs. It's my hope that by the end of each episode, this big world will feel just a bit smaller. Let's get started, shall we? Okay, everybody, welcome back to another exciting episode of the Big World Made Small Adventure Travel Podcast. Today, we've got Doug Grimes. He is the president of Mir Corporation. Doug, so happy to have you here on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Doug, last time we spoke, you'd shared some stories of fascinating places that you've been that very few of our listeners, I'm sure, have had the opportunity to visit, and I definitely want to get into that. And before we get into that, I'd love to learn a little bit about you, kind of what got you into this and kind of a little bit about your story so we can just kind of connect with you on that level. So where would you like to start?
Well, in the very beginning, I would have to say my parents, I think I mentioned this, my parents were sort of peaceniks and got me involved with citizen exchanges with the Soviet Union. And actually my first trip there was a volleyball exchange. My father was a coach for many years. And that's how I got hooked, I would say.
How old were you when you did that trip?
I was 27.
Okay.
And it wasn't actually that long after that that I started a company. Because I came back from that volleyball trip, which was right at the beginning of kind of perestroika and glasnost. For those of you who remember that from Gorbachev's time, it was a sort of restructuring and opening up of the Soviet Union. And there was a lot of changes and stuff happening. And so we started Mir and Mir Corporation, actually, which is kind of interesting, or Korporatsiya was the Russian version at that time, mainly because there was this idea that companies or from Soviet times were not good.
Okay.
And we were trying to break down this sort of stereotype that corporation was not a bad word. At the time, and Mir means peace and world in Russian. It also means world in Ukrainian and some other Slavic languages. So, that's where the name came from. And, I really enjoyed, my trips there. I got heavily involved with travel and doing these exchanges at first, which was like a two-part exchange. So we would take a group of, say, doctors and travel around different cities and visit with Soviet doctors, and then 6 months later we would host a group of doctors in the U.S.
Oh wow! I'm curious, Doug, was the Soviet government at the time, were they involved in the corporation at all? Or, without going into great detail of how you were set up, I'm just curious, was this a partnership or something you were just doing on your own?
Well, it was a partnership, but it was through a kind of secondary travel company that was under the trade union organization. So there's this... At that time, most people kind of remember there was InTourist, which was kind of a government-sponsored for foreign tourists. There was something called Sputnik, which was for youth travel. And then there was this Central Council for Tourism Excursia, which was for Comecon countries. So when somebody from communist Czechoslovakia came to Moscow, they would have their travel arrangements done through them. And I kind of entered this backdoor arrangement with them to be able to do these, you know, exchanges. It went very well. We did a lot of trips. We worked with a lot of nonprofit organizations, and even Patch Adams was one of my clients for many years. He would go and clown around in Russia every winter and visit, you know, we'd set up visits to children's hospitals and orphanages, and you know, then of course the Soviet Union started to fall apart. And basically when it collapsed, we had to sort of reimagine our business model as a company, and started with 17 new countries, and kind of promoting those places more, I would say, more general tourism and kind of cultural tourism and some active adventure. So since then, that's what we've been focused on as a company, and, you know, had lots of experience in doing lots of different things just because of our unique, I would say, position in the industry was more, we are specialists in these regions and these areas. And if you want to go there and do something, whether it's private or a group or some unusual thing like Blue Planet Run. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but that was a run around the world. And we handled all the logistics from basically the Belarusian border to the Sea of Japan. Was a 24-hour nonstop run with people passing the baton. So one person would do 10 kilometers, pass it to somebody, and it was all day, all night. It never stopped.
Wow.
And so it was for a travel company, it was a very logistically challenging arrangement, because we had, you know, eight, I think 11 vehicles, and they were kind of one passing the other. And then somebody had to drive, you know, to the next city to sleep, you know, so they were ready in the middle of the night and vice versa. And, yeah.
Literally a lot of moving parts. A tough operation to run. I'm sure it sounds complicated.
Yeah.
I'm curious, when you said the Soviet Union kind of fell apart and you had to reimagine, I think is the word you used. Did it get easier or more complicated? Because you had a lot of the ins and the connections and the partnerships that just kind of, I guess, probably crumbled a little bit, some of them. So did life get easier for you? Was it?
It was definitely more challenging, I would say, especially in the beginning. I had kind of honestly pre-breakup of the Soviet Union had started working with setting up a small private enterprise actually in Russia to also start handling travel arrangements and stuff away from this trade union organization. And so we had a little bit of a head start already.
Was that because you saw you were able to kind of see what was happening, or did that you were doing that independently, or?
I certainly didn't expect that things would break up so quickly in that. But it was a time of opening, and so there was these new kind of free enterprise companies. They call them cooperatives, which was kind of the first step in allowing a small business enterprise in the Soviet Union at the time. And I thought, oh, we should be supporting that. And so I had found a partner, and he was already doing some things, and we kind of added the travel element to it. And that was sort of the beginning. And then I think it was like almost every year after that, I had to like re-register a new entity because it kept changing so much. And, you know, but we did. And actually it was kind of a good thing we did, because the very main contact with the trade unions that I had and had established over the years was a fellow who was quite high up in the organization. And he kind of just disappeared one day.
Okay.
I have a feeling he like went to Cyprus or something. But I never heard from him again, actually, ever. Okay. So it was a good thing that we had this other kind of setup because it allowed us to move forward, you know, without a big gap or anything like that. And but in terms of challenge, of course, then it was all these new countries kind of figuring out, okay, who's in charge and like, you know, so it was almost like starting over. It pretty much was starting over.
I can imagine. Yeah. I can imagine they had a lot of kind of patterns or routines in place that then when all of a sudden you've got all these individual countries, they're probably a lot of just trying to figure stuff out on every level.
Exactly. And
The history of, you know, or the past anyway, that the way it's set up isn't going to work in this new world, but the patterns are still there and the attitudes and ideas, I'm sure, probably took a little while to get shifted.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of like a wild, I would say wild east, you know, people were figuring things out and so were we. I mean, the business had to be kind of rebuilt at that time too, because quite a few of the organizations that we worked with that were doing these exchanges suddenly decided, oh, we've kind of done our job and we don't need to do that anymore, you know? And so we had to kind of go after a new market and ourselves. And so it was kind of like, oh, okay, well, how are we going to do this now? You know? And it took a long time too, because with that change, there was instability as well. And so it wasn't that many people, you know, like, oh, let's all go to Tajikistan now, you know, you know, it's open. I mean, there was a few, but not, it wasn't people like flooding like France or something, you know,
right.
Let's go to Paris.
Well, and as a tour operator that is trying to put together trips and send people on these trips, uncertainty is not something you want a lot of. That's a challenge as a tour operator, because the people going on these trips expect us, that's, they're booking a trip with you because they want the certainty. They want to kind of know what to expect from it. So I can imagine that was quite challenging. And Doug, I want to take advantage of the opportunity that I have here, because I don't think I've ever had a conversation with someone that knows as much about the former Soviet Union and then this whole thing that has happened. So I'm just going to, probably not tourism related, but do you feel that the typical person in Russia or any one of these countries generally feels that things are better off now, or are there still a lot of people that reflect back and say, well, it was easier in the past, or what's the general consensus of how people feel about everything with the Soviet Union collapse?
You know, I think I would say it's mixed. there definitely are still people that are nostalgic for those days and kind of remember the positive things. I would say that's more of the older generation, and that the younger generation has really embraced a more free enterprise and, you know, free press and looking forward and, you know, instead of backwards, I would say, you know, given current situation, it's fairly difficult for me to, you know, like even talk about Russia, to be honest with you.
Yeah. No,
I still have a lot of, you know, contacts and friends there and stuff. And, you know, I can tell you that they, at least, you know, in terms of my age or younger, you know, they're, you know, not supportive of this war and, you know, are afraid to speak out about it, actually. And that's, you know, to me, just sad, you know. Yep. And so, having spent, you know, 36 years kind of trying to foster the belief that, you know, we're all people and, you know, people are people no matter where you are. And actually we have, as it's interesting because one of the things that a lot of people visiting Russia felt, there was like this kinship with Russian people, you know, we're very similar, you know, in kind of our, you know, just thoughts and culture and certain things anyway,
right.
That it was easy to get along with them. And, you know, I feel like that's, you know, we've gone backwards, you know, a lot of years to, and then, you know, I'm not sure what's going to happen.
It's a difficult situation for everyone involved, and you're closer to it than most Americans.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you sharing that with us, and I can also appreciate why we're not going to go too much further into that. And though you said something else that was interesting, mm-hmm. you said that at one point, kind of as the Soviet Union collapsed, there were people that were like, okay, well, we did our job. We don't need to do that anymore. So they go do whatever maybe they really wanted to do. I'm just curious, like, did you find like the people that you were interacting with prior to that time, let's just say maybe a guide, let's just call them a guide, a person that's interacting with your guests. Mm-hmm. And you look at the guide profile back then compared to the guide profile, maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, did you find that the newer guides or the people that were doing it more recently were doing it because they wanted to do it and not because it was just the job that was assigned to them? Did you notice that difference?
I think that happened very early, you know, in not that short, like in the mid 1990s. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, I would say smart, you know, people with really good English that, you know, studied, you know, to be guides and wanted to, and that was really their desire. And, you know, some of them I know are still, you know, guides today, and they, you know, that's what they want to do, and they love that job. And, so yeah, I think it's certainly more of a choice thing. And, you know, people in the industry, I mean, let's face it, people get into travel, they, it's kind of hard to get out of it because mm-hmm. you get hooked and, you know, it's like you kept, you know, I mean, I've traveled a lot myself. I've been to, you know, all of our, almost all our places and been to Russia, you know, over 100 times and Central Asia. And, you know, we have an office in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, and one in Georgia, in Tbilisi, Georgia. And, you know, I travel to these places, a lot of the times the same places, but I'm always thinking about, oh, where haven't I been yet too, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, or what's my next trip going to be, you know, it only lasts about a week or two when you're home and then you're like, okay, I'm, you know, where should I go next? You know, it gets under your skin, you know?
I do the same thing. I just like, I pull out my phone. I'm looking at flights all the time. I'm like, last time you and I spoke, we spoke a little bit about Georgia, mm-hmm. and I'd mentioned to you that I'd already been looking at like Airbnbs there, and I was like, it's so hard for me to stay put, and so I get that completely. Yeah. And also, I, like back on the guide thing, I'm trying to imagine like a guide working with a guide that is doing it because his somebody above him said you're going to be a guide.
Yeah.
Your job is to escort people and make sure they take pictures of the right things and not the right another thing, you know? And I'm like, yeah, that just doesn't sound like a lot of fun to be with a guide like that. Whereas typically guides in most places are doing it because they're passionate about it. They're excited about it. They want to have the engagement and the cultural exchange. So I kind of imagine that I'm sure it shifted probably pretty quickly. So
Cool. It did. I mean, it was not, you know, within a few years after the Soviet Union fell apart that I think the whole guide pool was different, you know.
Can imagine that. Yep, that makes sense. So you also mentioned, you said, you know, you're thinking about where have I not been? I guess I just want to ask a question. You know, magic wand, you can go anywhere for, you know, let's say a couple weeks, and where would you go right now?
Oh, you know, that's kind of a trick question a little bit, because my first thought, to be honest with you, it would be to go back to Georgia. It's one of my favorite places. And my partner and I, Annie, we have an apartment in Tbilisi. You know, we like to go spend time there. We have some kind of tourism development projects that are, you know, not far from the capital. And so, you know, we're always kind of scheming, like, okay, when can we go back, you know? And so that, I don't know, that's the same time there's definitely some places on my list that I would like to go that I haven't been. Like, I've never been to India. You know, I've never been to Egypt, surprisingly. You know, so some places that maybe a lot of other people have been to that I haven't, you know, because I spend so much time going to our places, you know.
So much time in places that most people have not been. Very few people have been.
Right.
You, and there's a few, let's dig into a couple of those, because as I recall, you said that we discussed a little bit about North Korea. And I'd love to kind of dig into that a little bit. What are you comfortable sharing with us about that experience? And what do you think people should know?
Yeah, well, there was a, I think, a window in time that was pre-Trump, let's say, where things were, you know, kind of moving in a positive direction. It seemed like there was talks were starting and things were, you know, kind of opening up and it, you know, it was okay to travel there. I mean, in general. So I went as on a kind of representative trip. It was like an inspection trip. And I was the only American. But, you know, there was like a couple from Germany and a Swiss fellow and somebody from China and somebody from, you know, so it was like an international kind of delegation of people from the travel industry. And, you know, we each had our own guide kind of watching after us and traveled around, you know, Pyongyang and down to the DMZ, the demilitarization zone border. So between North Korea and South Korea and several other parts of the country. So that was kind of my introduction. I thought it was fascinating. It reminded me a lot of kind of really early days of the Soviet times and, you know, quite even more restrictive, I would say, in terms of what you can and can't do. And, but still, you know, it was a introduction to the people in the country and got to talk to people individually and kind of see the countryside. And
so what was the, I don't want to assume anything. It sounds like this is a, bring in some tour operators, show them all the great stuff that we have to offer so that maybe they will start bringing clients. Was that kind of the idea? And sponsored by the state, I assume.
Yeah, it was sponsored by the, you know, state tourism organization. Yeah, and that was the whole idea. And people did, you know, people did started bringing trips, including us. We did a series of small group trips there over the next, I would say, year. And then some people might remember that was kind of right around the time when I think Dennis Rodman went to North Korea the first time. So it was around that time. Anyway, you know, I had some very interesting experiences there, which one I can just tell you quickly about was down at the DMZ. I was with, you know, this group, and the DMZ tour is given by a guy in military uniform, and you kind of wind your way in, and there's a multi-story building that sort of overlooks these three little houses where in each house the border is like in the middle of the house and there's a table and there's a line and, you know. Anyway, so he's giving his little spiel and talking about, you know, this is the DMZ and, you know, and if the Americans do this, we will launch our nuclear weapons and destroy the United States, you know.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, you can take pictures, you know. And so right after that, I go up to him like, I'm Doug Grimes. I'm from the United States. Yeah. Shake. And he's like, oh, you know. And I said, yeah, okay, can I have a picture with you? And I just want you to know that, you know, hey, we're people just like you. And, you know, sometimes politics get in the way and, you know, we should be friends. Yeah. And he's like, oh, okay.
How did he receive that?
Yeah, he was a little standoffish at first, but then, yeah, he smiled and you know, I said, well, you know, what do you like to do for your, you know, in your spare time? Somehow we talked about that we both like beer.
Ah, so, okay.
And so then the tour was over and we came back to the place where the tour started, and there's like a gift shop where they sell stuff, and I go in and I said, hey, do you guys have any beers, you know? And they're looking at me like, oh, yeah, but it's not cold. And do you want ice? And I'm like, no, just give me two cans of beer, you know. Mm-hmm. And bought the beers and then asked my guide. I said, hey, can I give this guy a beer? She's like, oh, sure, you know. So I went up and said, hey, you know, it's nice to meet you. And I wanted to buy your beer. And here you go. Yeah. And at first he's like, cool. Oh, no, I can't take it. You know. And the guide said, you know, and then the guide said something. And he said, well, okay, you know. And so, you know, he smiled, he took the beer, you know, I made a kind of small connection with him. And sure enough, my second trip there, I came back and it was the same guy. And he's like, the beer guy.
Oh,
that, you know, and smiled. That
is, yeah. You know? That is so cool. And the guide, you mentioned the guide was there and kind of had a conversation with the soldier. Mm-hmm. Would you use the term kind of handler for the guide that you're with? Is that kind of gave the soldier permission to go ahead and accept the beer, it sounds like?
Yeah. The guides there are responsible for the people and responsible to, you know, make sure you don't leave the hotel at night. And you're not supposed to go out of the hotel by yourself at all. So,
and that's to keep you safe, right, Doug?
Yeah, to keep you safe.
Yeah.
Keep you out of trouble, you know. So anyway, it was a window in time. I mean, we haven't done trips there since then, unfortunately, and it's not really on the radar right now.
I'm curious though, because what I hear you saying is your business didn't continue to take trips there for political reasons, all that. But I'm curious about the tour operators from other countries. Have they continued doing trips or?
Some did for a time while after that, especially there was some operators out of China mm-hmm. that were doing that. And I think they still are, but, with certain restrictions, I mean, like in terms of who you can take with you. So now, as far as I know, Americans are not able to travel there.
Are you optimistic that you'll be able to offer trips there? I mean, I know this is like, who knows, right?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, I think if somehow the, you know, relations between North and South kind of started talks again and maybe going in the right direction, and it looked like things were going to, you know, kind of open up more, then, you know, might be consider that as good timing. Honestly, right now we're, you know, kind of focused on other areas. So
yeah, that's kind of where I was going with it. I was curious if all of a sudden things were better and they said, okay, you can come back to North Korea, like, would you be excited about that? Would you put a lot of effort and resources into that? Or do you feel like there's just other opportunities out there for your clients that are maybe just better? I don't know.
I think there's a lot of opportunities in our current, you know, destinations we offer. And there's a lot of people who have not been to some of those places or have just scratched the surface, you know. I would certainly consider it, you know, if the conditions were right, because, you know, we know a certain amount about it. I've, you know, personally been there 3 times. I feel like, you know, we could maybe offer people in doing it with kind of the right guidance and perspective and stuff.
Yeah. Got it. So we've discussed Russia, we've discussed North Korea. Both are places that not a lot of people are chomping at the bit to go right now, or the limitation, or even able to go, I should say. So let's shift focus to those places that you're excited to send people to right now.
Yeah. Well, one of the kind of hot areas for us and is doing really well, finally kind of recovered this year after, you know, being closed from COVID and that. And actually one of the last countries to finally open after COVID was Turkmenistan, which is in Central Asia. And we, you know, missed the spring window with them because they I think they opened at the end of April. So, and the season for Central Asia is typically spring and fall because of the, you know, desert climate there. It's part of the old Silk Road. You know, Uzbekistan is where kind of the, I would say, the real gems of that region are in terms of some of the historical architecture and the beautiful blue minarets and, you know, blue tiled minarets and mosques and noble squares and fortresses and you know, the people themselves and the handicrafts and things like that have all, you know, come back and are flourishing now. And tourism is kind of booming in the area, actually. You know, less so for North Americans, but, you know, there's a lot of Europeans traveling there. There's lots of people from, not only China, but also India and, really all over from different parts of the world.
What do you think's getting in the way of more North Americans visiting?
I think it's just the knowledge of the, you know, in terms of, you know, knowing how great it is and, you know, what there is to see and experience there, but also it's far. I mean, it's literally from where I am, my home in Seattle, it's exactly 12 hours difference. So it's on the other side of the globe. Mm-hmm. So, you know, getting there is challenging in terms of, you know, how far you have to fly and of course expense for flying that far. But you know, there's more and more choices all the time for that. I mean, I think Turkish Air now has, you know, five or six cities that they service just in Uzbekistan itself, directly from Istanbul. So, you know, it used to be just the capital cities, you know, like Tashkent. Mm-hmm. And now there's like secondary cities even. And I mean, some of them are like flights every day or 4 days a week. And like Tashkent itself, I think is like at least two flights a day or something like that. So, and not just them, but there's United Arab Emirates, you know, Lufthansa has some service in there. Korean Air going the other direction from Seoul. You know, so there's more and more access seems to be coming on, and I think that's helping. One of our most popular trips that we do in the region is called Journey Through Central Asia, the Five Stands. So we claim that we coined the Five Stands as a thing. I'm pretty sure we did. and it is, I think, popular because you are kind of seeing not just one country, but you're seeing five countries and the region all in one trip. That trip is like 22 days long, and you know, still you're kind of moving quickly, you know, even with that, to kind of take in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, you know, which is more Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, at least the parts we go to, are more mountainous and kind of more I would say a little bit more adventurous. And then Uzbekistan is more kind of city-based, and you're going from sort of desert citadel city to the next desert citadel city. And Turkmenistan is like one of those places that most people don't know anything about and is kind of it's a little bit like North Korea, to be honest with you. It's kind of, controlled sort of society. Doesn't seem as it's not as controlled, I would say, as North Korea. But anyway, it has that same sort of leadership down feel.
Is it a socialist country still? Are they still communists? I'll admit, I know almost nothing about the area, which is part of why I wanted to have this conversation with you.
Yeah.
So,
The leadership there is currently the president is the son of the previous president, who was the doctor of the original Soviet leader.
Okay.
Who died mysteriously, and the doctor became the president.
That doesn't sound suspicious at all. I'm sure there's a deathbed confession. I want you to take over. Thank you as a reward.
Yeah. It's a fascinating place. I think it's one of those kind of places that you want to go and sort of see for yourself to kind of understand it, understand the culture in that. They have one of the claim to fames is the most white marble of any city in the world is Ashgabat. Ashgabat was kind of built up. They have a big natural gas like underground in Turkmenistan. Mm-hmm. It's one of the biggest reserves or something. And a matter of fact, one of the other famous places there is this famous pit of hell, it's called. It's the burning Darvaza, which is a giant sinkhole in the desert that
caught on fire.
After it. They were, I guess, doing some kind of excavations or something in this like giant sinkhole, and then it's been burning ever since. And you can go out and stay in the middle of the desert, near this. And it's this giant, flaming kind of hole. And at night, it looks like a beam of light going up into, space. And it's pretty interesting and something very, very different, that you don't see anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, I think I've seen that on YouTube or a documentary somewhere. And it's like different colors, right? Are the flames, or maybe I'm thinking of another spot, but
It's not really. Yeah. I mean, maybe at night it's a little bit different, but it's basically natural gas that's just burning,
Okay.
And has all been, right. And you can get fairly close to the edge. You can come up to it and see, look in to the pit and see the flames and,
Good for Instagram photos too.
Oh yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
And so there's a nice yurt camp now close by, so you can overnight there, and it has proper facilities and stuff. Used to be the only way to stay there was like set up a tent, we would arrange like a tent camp for one night or something. But
right.
Now there's a nearby yurt camp facility with a restaurant and, places to stay in regular bathrooms with showers and everything. So,
all right. So one thing you mentioned a few things about kind of the architecture of the area. You were discussing mm-hmm. marble and the blue tile mosques, I guess it was. You did also mention the people and culture. I'm really curious mm-hmm. about that. What should we know about the people there that, that your clients are engaging with?
Yeah. Well, I would say, and this is true for, I would say, all over Central Asia, is that, the hospitality is very high there, and people are very friendly, and, it's a common question to get asked, when you're walking around the old towns or that, like, oh, where are you from, oh, I'm from U.S., and, welcome, and, we're happy to have you here. And, I have a cousin that lives in you know, Toronto, and I'm like, well, that's Canada, but, you know, or something like that, or Wisconsin, maybe, you know. So it's not uncommon to, you know, meet people and have them be like super friendly, invite them into their home for tea is very common there. And, you know, they have also tea houses, where people will invite you for, you know, to sit down and have tea and chat. And, you know, so I would say that, you know, in terms of the culture, it's very, you know, it's a very positive experience for people visiting. it took some time, I think, after the Soviet Union for people to sort of embrace their, re-embrace their original, you know, like Uzbek culture or Kyrgyz. And, you know, that has, I would say, fostered and been encouraged, you know, and, you know, you can really feel that sort of distinctions between the five Central Asian countries by, you know, the traditional dress or sort of, you know, Kyrgyzstan is really known for its like horsemanship and, you know, the steppe, and people have original, some people still live and then raise animals and live in traditional Kyrgyz, you know, yurts, and you can go and see how a yurt is made, and it's different from Mongolian style yurt, you know, and, what are the differences and sort of handicrafts and things like that. And, you know, that is really kind of come into its own, I would say, in each country.
What do you think prompted that? You think it's just kind of a pride that comes back, or has tourism helped encourage that, or?
Yeah, I would say both. You know, the pride and, you know, wanting to kind of reconnect with those original sort of Uzbek traditions or Kyrgyz traditions or Turkmen or whatever, and to bring them back into their family and their society. And yeah, the handicrafts have certainly, I think, you know, having a lot of visitors come and it being a part of, you know, sustainability for people, you know, there's a lot of, you know, independent entrepreneurs or small businesses that are relying on, you know, visitors, whether it's, you know, miniature paintings or, traditional hand stitched Suzanais, which I don't know if you can see in the back behind me there. There's one hanging, you know, hats, ceramics. You know, there's a ceramics master in the capital, Tashkent, that's like a sixth or seventh generation, ceramics master, has, you know, been passed down from son to son, you know, family. And they still use, you know, traditional dyes and methods for their pottery and things like that. So I think those have really been embraced because, partially because they were sort of taken away during Soviet times, you know, and it's like people were looking for, you know, how can we bring back our, you know, identity and share that with, you know, visitors and that. So
was there a resurgence in religion as well with all these churches and mosques, and what does that look like for the area?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. There's, you know, Central Asia is mostly Muslim. You know, I'd say it's a very, you know, secular or tolerant, and not very strict. But still, you know, people go, you know, pray at mosques, and some people are more sort of religious than others, and you don't see in the area, you know, too many women with, you know, their heads covered or things like that. You know, some, I think it's more a personal preference. There's no, you know, kind of government mandates about it or anything like that, like in some other countries, you know.
Right. Right. No, that makes sense.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, for instance, Bukhara, which is a, you know, very, very old city and still, you know, has that kind of old mud brick feel in the old town where you walk around very narrow streets and that, and you'll come around a corner and there's a small, you know, mosque. And then, you know, two blocks later, there's a synagogue, you know, and, you know, because there was a big Jewish quarter in Bukhara, you know, there used to be a actually quite thriving Bukharan Jews. that were from, you know, that area. It's not as prevalent as it used to be. And it's, you know, because of during Soviet times and that, a lot of people immigrated to Israel and other places, you know. But there's still, you know, a Jewish quarter in Bukhara. And, you know, there's also an Armenian quarter, and there's, you know, a Christian, which is more sort of Orthodox Christian. And, you know, so it's a mix. And I find, you know, you find, especially cities like Bukhara, where it's like, you know, there's not a tension about it or anything. You know, people are, you know, living amongst themselves, you know, freely. So,
interesting. So, I think maybe some of our listeners and myself included, I really like to enjoy different types of food as I travel. Yeah. So is there anything noteworthy that our listeners should know about food in Central Asia in these countries?
Yeah, well, the food scene has been, I would say, is developing a little bit slower than some of our other, I would say, other areas like the Caucasus is a little bit, I would say, farther ahead, in my opinion, in terms of diversity and you know, choices and that. I mean, I would say more recently, like within the last 3 to 5 years, there's kind of a little bit more creativity happening. It used to be pretty much a very meat and potatoes, a lot of shish kebabs and, you know, that kind of thing, which is still a big, you know, main staple for the region, I would say. But, you know, depending on which country you're in, you know, people will say, oh, well, we're famous for instance, Uzbekistan, we, you know, we're famous for our plov. Plov is like a rice dish that takes, you know, 6 hours to make, and, you know, you have to make it with this and that. And I mean, they have these big, there's a really kind of cool restaurant in Tashkent, which is a real, I would say, locals place too. It's not really made for tourists, but it's a big plov center. And, you know, they have these 6 or 8 foot, you know, circular walks, you know, on fire, you know, that they're making this giant plov in, and, you know, serving everybody a bowl from this giant, huge, you know, plov dishes. And, you know, so that's a kind of a cool place to go and get like a local meal. And it's inexpensive too, but really, you know, tasty. You know, but there are also new places too that are like doing, like I said, more innovative things, like taking sort of old recipes and, you know, making new dishes and things like that. So that's just kind of starting to happen in Uzbekistan. You know, parts of Kazakhstan has maybe, I would say, a little bit more, has more variety because they've got more sort of European restaurants they've adopted and things like that. The new capital there, Astana, which is kind of in the center of Kazakhstan. The former capital was Almaty, which is in the south. It was very close to the Kyrgyz border. And, some years back, the president that was, at that time decided to centralize the capital, and it was moved to this new location, which was at that time just like a small village. And, so the capital there is now like this whole new city, you know, everything was built from nothing, you know, and it's pretty impressive actually. So they've got all their, you know, government buildings, and of course then there's commerce, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, hotels there. And so with that came more sort of European restaurants and things, that sort of developed during that time. Other places, you know, more traditional still. Turkmenistan is, I would say, you know, pretty traditional still in terms of, you know, not a lot of choices, but, you know, some Tajikistan, I haven't really mentioned much. That's the southern kind of neighbor of Uzbekistan, has a border with a big part of its southern borders with Afghanistan. And it's mostly mountainous. It's like 92% mountains, I think, is the territory of Tajikistan. And it's famous for its Pamir Highway, which runs right along that Afghan border for a big section and then winds its way up into Kyrgyzstan and then the border with China in the very far western part of China. And, you know, the highest peak in Central Asia is located in Tajikistan. So okay. for climbers and that's, you know, it used to be called Peak Communism. It's one of the seven summits, you know. So, yeah, a bit more adventurous there. You know, most of the road system is still very rough, I would say. You know, and you need like four-wheel drive for a good portion of that, you know, Pamir Highway. And, you know, you're talking about like high kind of remote mountain villages and fantastic scenery and, you know, passes and things like that. That, and a lot of it untouched, you know, that it's hard to find anymore these days. So
that's very cool. I've got one more food question and then I want to get to logistics a little bit. I want to get back to the logistics. As you were speaking, I saw something on YouTube. I think it was in Central Asia. If not, you probably know where this is, but they had these big clay ovens with a hole in the top of them. And the guys would take a big ball of dough and lean into the hole and smack it up against the inside of the oven. And it was a way of making bread of some sort. Does that sound familiar to you?
Oh yeah. 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 That's a very traditional bread of Central Asia.
Okay.
Made in the,
at least I'm in the right part of the world. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, it's a big clay oven and usually it's with regular coals and fire. It's not a, you know, gas or whatever, the traditional way. And each town is kind of has its own sort of stamps or symbols that they put in the bread. So the bread is first, like you said, made into circles. And then they slap it into the side of the clay oven. And then when they pull it out, they've pre-stamped kind of the center part of it. And those stamps kind of change depending on, you know, where, what village or what, you know, bakery or something. And, you know.
So you've seen this done, I assume.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like. And when I watched it, it was quite fascinating because, frankly, these guys look like they're going to fall into the hole. just from what I saw, I don't know if maybe the video is a little bit more extreme, but they like lean into the oven and like smack it up in the inside of there and then come back out. And I just thought, wow, that has to be incredibly dangerous because if they're not strapped in, as far as I can tell, they're just, I don't know. Is that nerve wracking to watch them do that? Or would you do it?
I've done it. I've tried it. it wasn't having to lean down too much because it was, this one was, the hole was sort of made in a side. So you could reach in sideways, but you still had, you know, you're reaching in there with the flames and it's hot.
Yeah.
You know,
these guys, the hole was right in the top of the thing. And they were like, it blew me away. So anybody that's interested, go look that up on YouTube. What do you call it?
I'm not sure if it has a tandoor. Bread. It's like a tandoor oven, you know, they call it. So
That's interesting. Yeah. So, but anyway, I wanted to ask you about that because I thought that was pretty interesting. Yeah. I'd like to see that. So,
if you go to the bazaar, for instance, Samarkand, like their famous market bazaar, there's like a whole bread section, and like every stand, and they've got tons of different kinds of breads, and some of them decorated and some not. And it's like really pretty. And, very cool. And the bread is like super tasty too. I mean, is it? You know, yeah. Especially cool. Coming right out of the ovens and breaking off a piece. And, you know.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, I just love going to like little bakeries, and like a croissant with a coffee is like just, I just love to try that. Everywhere I go, I want something kind of like that. Mm-hmm. But okay, so back to logistics, because as you were describing these places, I was curious, are these most of these places or some of these places the type of place where a digital nomad could go? Let's say you work remotely and you can just go and travel around. Are these places that I could just book a ticket, fly in, get an Airbnb, rent a car, hang out for months at a time, or is it more restricted than that? Because one of the countries you mentioned sounded like it was quite restricted.
Yeah. I would say in general, Central Asia's, I'm not sure that high on the list of any of those countries and for digital nomading. Maybe Kyrgyzstan, just because they have a little bit more liberal, you know, in terms of how long you can stay and things like that.
Okay.
The one country that is, I would say, really good for that would be, again, Georgia in the South Caucasus, because you can go without a visa as a U.S. passport holder for a year. You can stay there without a visa, and you can work too as a kind of digital nomad or. I mean, you can open a bank account. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that I don't know the number now, but it used to be in the top 10 of ease of doing business or something like that. Was Georgia. That has also just to be aware, has been one of the real appealing countries for Russians to go to that were trying to get away from the war. So, and that has affected the economy in Georgia some, because, with big flood of, 100,000, Russians coming, last year, it's been, I would say, a little over a year now that kind of when that started, drove up the, rents and, prices and stuff quite a bit. So some of the, where it used to be really inexpensive to live there, you could get like an apartment for, a couple $100 a month or something. It's now like double or triple that, which is still inexpensive. And so there are people that I know are digital nomads that are, taking advantage of spending time there. The other thing is you can leave for, a few days and come back and stay another year. So,
Oh, nice. All right. It's starting to sound better and better as you speak.
So that's one of the, I would say for our areas, probably the top one. I'd have to look and see. I think I want to say Romania also has some, kind of has geared some positive things toward digital nomads, in terms of encouraging that, or at least it used to be. I'm not sure if it still is.
Yeah. Well, let's remove the digital nomad part of the equation. Let's take that out of the equation and go back to Central Asia.
Sure.
And maybe, I guess the question, maybe I should have phrased it like, could somebody just go there and find their way around, be safe and have great experiences, or do they really need to go with a tour operator to be able to experience? I mean, things are always better with a great tour operator. I get that. And we're having this discussion. And is this the type of place where you could go book a room for a couple of weeks, rent a car, drive around, explore, and get something out of it? Or is it just a waste of time?
I mean, you could. I think the caveat with that was, do you have time to waste? Because some things would really, take time to kind of find the right contact or, setting up, kind of the right places, or, just going and renting a car is not so straightforward, as other parts of the world and, things like that. So if you have, spare time, certainly I think it's possible, and people do it, and if it's high season, it's also can be challenging because a lot of places honestly are full. And we're finding, you know, we have to book stuff earlier and earlier. And so that's the other thing that could be challenging is like you think, oh, I'm going to show up in September. And then it's like you can't even find a one space in like a hotel at 10 hotels in Tashkent or something, you know.
So it sounds like the do-it-yourself thing, Robbie, is better in Europe or some other places. And this sounds like something that's just...
I'm not saying you can't do it. It's I would just, you know, you'd have to do some pre-planning yourself, I think, you know.
Yeah.
To be able to make it happen, you know, without running into a lot of... Not a lot, but I mean, certainly running into some stumbling blocks and things that... You know, so most people, I mean, that we're kind of working with, you know, don't have a lot of extra time to waste. And so, you know, we're trying to, you know, set as much up as possible to kind of give them what they want. And we have small group trips, but we also do private journeys. So, you know, somebody can say, oh, I just want to go and spend 10 days and, you know, do this and that, or this is the most important thing for me. And, you know, we can set it up from scratch, you know, so.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And I just realized, you know, recognize that some countries are easier than others. Some countries, you know, you go to New Zealand, rent a car, you can go see a lot of cool stuff. But other countries are more, you know, well-suited to an organized itinerary with like, okay, there's a lot of distance in between the different things you want to see. And let's not waste your time trying to figure out how to get from point A to point B and let's just make it happen. So I appreciate the insights there. And I did want to touch on one more, if you've got a moment. I'd love, we talked a little bit about Iran.
Yep.
Is there anything notable there that we should discuss that our listeners might be kind of an eye opener for them?
I think the first thing is, you know, you can go to Iran. There's no restriction technically in terms of being able to travel there as a U.S. passport holder. If you look at the State Department warnings and stuff, it's obviously level 4 and they discourage that. But you know, that's not the only place in the world that's like that. So, you know, it's certainly possible. We've done trips and programming in Iran for over 25 years, actually, as a company. It's probably not a place I would suggest going on your own. You know, better to have it organized and you need a visa, and the visa process is pretty extensive. So, it's not necessarily a problem. It just takes time and planning and that, you know, at different times of, I would say our involvement with doing trips to Iran, you know, it's kind of been boom or bust. So, you know, there's not a lot of, interest in it right now, especially after recent events and, in the Middle East, Israel, but you know, I don't know, 8-10 years ago, I think one year we had maybe 600 Americans in one year traveling to Iran. So destination itself is certainly worth a visit if the timing's right, because it's, you know, ancient Persian culture and architecture and fantastic archaeological sites, and you know, and talk about hospitality with people. It's one of the, I would say, you know, some of the most friendliest people I've ever met, you know, in Iran, and just people from the street, you know. And so, you know, that said, we as a company shifted kind of our focus a little bit after, like, sort of during COVID. We had decided we were going to expand a little bit into the Middle East because we'd already had Iran and Turkey, and we added Saudi Arabia and Oman, UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Jordan, and Iraq to our kind of offerings, and kind of had kicked that off earlier this year, And I don't know, it seems we like to pick places that are controversial or something, you know, because
you named a few.
Started off quite well, and you know, now I'm still very positive about the region, and I think I have to say, especially Oman and Saudi Arabia, I think have a lot to offer, and their tourism is pretty new to that area. I mean, Saudi Arabia only opened to tourism really in the fall of 2019, and it was only for a short time, and then COVID happened. So, you know, international tourism to Saudi Arabia is new, you know, it's very new. And it has, well, I think the country itself has a lot to offer. So
it'll be interesting to see what develops in the world as a whole, but
yeah,
I got to give you credit though, Doug, you're pretty adventurous and I'm going to say ballsy because I've spoken with so many tour operators over the years and then with this podcast and for you to like, oh, I'm going to start my tourism career with the Soviet Union,
yeah,
North Korea, you know, Central Asia, Iran, and all these different places. That takes some serious commitment either to kind of just your vision of connecting people. I believe, you know, Mir, let's go back to the, you know, the name of your business, right?
Yeah.
You said it was world or and peace, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been our philosophy even up until now that we, you know, I believe that people, I mean, it's one thing to listen to news and stuff, and, you know, it's another thing to go in person and really meet someone yourself from a country and sort of understand it from the perspective of your own viewpoint, you know. And I think that, you know, we'd have a lot less wars and disagreements in our world if everybody, you know, was more open to kind of visiting and traveling and learning about, you know, our cultures and you know, I mean, I have a friend in Saudi Arabia. I have a friend in Russia. I have a friend in Ukraine. You know, I have a friend in Iran, you know, I have a different perspective on, you know, the people and the culture there because of that. And
you have a friend down the DMZ in North Korea.
I do. I have a guy who likes beer just like me, you know.
It's so cool because I'm not knocking any tour operators. I think they're all doing what they're doing for a reason. And, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, I'm going to do trips to Paris. I'm going to do trips to Italy. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of value in that. But I think it's really clear as I listen to you and as I look at you here on the screen is that there's something bigger there behind this. It's not just tourism.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not just tourism, because if it was just tourism, you know, you're not doing Central Asia because you think nobody else is doing it and we can make a bunch of money, you know, or some of these countries. I'm just guessing. Mm-hmm. I respect that. So I just want to acknowledge that.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Thank you. Yeah. And Mir, we have a very good team, I would say. You know, we have a lot of people that have been with the company a long time and are very experienced. And Joanna, who's one of our salespeople, she was a guide on one of our early trips to Poland. And, you know, when she, you know, married an American and said, oh, I'm in the United States now. I said, oh, well, do you want to work for us? You know, and she's been with the company ever since. And, you know, we have a Ukrainian guy who's, you know, I mean, we have people who know the areas and really a good team of people that, you know, are passionate about our destinations as well and sharing them with our clients. So it's not just me.
Yeah. I get it. And but you've obviously attracted these people for a reason.
Sure.
Right. You know, so there's a lot to be said for that. Doug, we covered a lot of things. I have a feeling we could cover a lot more.
Okay.
And I'm curious though, at this point, is there anything I should have asked, forgot to ask, or anything that you think our listeners should know either about you, Doug, or about Mir, or about anything else before we wrap up?
I think there's a lot of information on our website. So that might be, a place that people could go. It's mircorp.com. And yep,
We'll have that linked in the show notes as well to make it real easy.
We do a lot of blog posts and kind of trying to help kind of spread the word about our destinations and educate people. And, like you said, not too many people know that much about the areas or the regions. And we feel like we're educators too. So, but I think I covered a lot of it, and I encourage everybody to check it out. And maybe we'll see you in Central Asia or the Caucasus or Middle East.
Very cool. Well, very interesting conversation, Doug. I appreciate you taking time to share all this with us. And you've got a bunch of ideas rolling around in my head, and I'm sure that anybody that's listening to this is, considering new places that they maybe never thought of before. Great. So thank you. I think we did a good job.
All right.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. All right. We'll connect with you soon. Okay. Thanks.
Bye.
I trust you enjoyed listening to the conversation as much as I enjoyed recording it. If you're enjoying the Big World Made Small podcast, please take a moment to tell the algorithm by subscribing and posting a review so that others can benefit as well. I also invite you to take a quick trip over to bigworldmadesmall.com and join our private adventure travel community to receive new episode notifications, special access to our guest experts, and perhaps even some exclusive partner offers that we haven't discussed on the podcast. I'll publish another episode soon. Until then, keep exploring. It's the best way to make a big world feel just a bit smaller.